Welcome to the Society of Advanced Bronchoscopy. This is The Way podcast. My name is Dominique Pepper, and in this podcast, we interview leaders and experts in advanced bronchoscopy and interventional pulmonology. And for today, we discuss choice of biopsy tool during bronchoscopy.
I'm Tom Gilday. I'm the section head of bronchoscopy and interventional pulmonary at the Cleveland Clinic.
An absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, Tom. Today we'll be discussing your paper. It's entitled The Impact of Biopsy Tool Choice and Rapid On-Site Evaluation on Diagnostic Accuracy for Malignant Lesions in the Prospective Multicenter Navigate Study. Maybe you could just kick us off first by informing our audience what was the Navigate study, and then we'll dive into biopsy tool choice.
So the Navigate study was a very large prospective cohort study. It was sort of a non-comparator study. I think there were 26 centers in the United States, and they collected over 1,200 patients over a year. And then there's continuing follow-up to look at the results of bronchoscopy with biopsies with the superdimension electromagnetic navigation system. And this goes back to older versions of the machine, back to, I think, versions 6.3 and 7.1, in fact. And it was intended to sort of get a better understanding of what the real world of electromagnetic navigation bronchoscopy was at the time.
Great. Well, then you decided to do a post hoc analysis investigating the impact of biopsy tool choice. Why did you decide to do that?
That's a great question. You know, it turns out that we've learned so much about electromagnetic navigation over the years, specifically with regard to all the things that impact yield that have nothing to do with the machine. So recently we're learning about, you know, atelectasis related to ventilation strategies, and there's been issues around what kind of sedation we should use, and then the addition of new navigation techniques and peripheral ultrasound. So over the years, many, many different aspects of the contributors to having a diagnostic yield been explored. And it always frustrated me that the biopsy itself was never really looked at, or at least not looked at in any great detail. And so this was an opportunity to sort of test out some of my theories I had about, you know, the nature of people doing bronchoscopy and biopsies across the different centers, and really assess whether or not there's a standard, and then what different strategies may impact the yield of the procedure independent of things like the navigation system or other factors. So this goes back to my fellowship days. You know, there's old papers about needles being better than all the other biopsy techniques. And there's different idioms that we've heard over the years about, you know, it's not the needle in the nodule, it's the nodule in the needle, or tissue's the issue, or you can't make a diagnosis without histopathology, all these things. And so I was really interested in to know what was the status of the current biopsy strategies in the world, and what could we learn from the Navigate data in terms of informing decisions about biopsy types.
Yeah, that's a really good overview. So let's talk about the different tools that you employed. What were they? And then we can dive into what your study methods were.
Sure. So the study was sort of designed around the idea that there are people take lots of different kinds of biopsies. And so the general concept of the wash brush biopsy was sort of how I learned to approach this, which included either a bronchial wash or a BAL, a cytology brush that can be deployed in the lung, or a transbronchial biopsy, that being the sort of standard. And that's how we did it, electromagnetic navigation bronchoscopy in the very early days. Over time, we learned to use the peripheral needle. You can imagine that the old Wang needles we had were very long, 13 to 15 millimeters long, and they really weren't good at deploying deep in the lung. And so the addition of all these new tools with the SuperTrax and other branded nodules made it easier to use needle biopsies in the periphery. And so that sort of extended the interest in these things. And then, of course, the Acquire registry data came out, and that showed that the use of a peripheral needle was associated with increased yield, but it was really only used 16% of the time in that paper. And so we had some ideas about, you know, all the different tools that can be used and if there's value in adding the additional tools. Now, the SuperDimension company and other folks in the field have added new tools like the triple needle brush, a needle brush, a GenCut, that's a brand name biopsy instrument, the bronchial wash, and all these different things have been added into the mix. And so we were curious to know if there is a strategy that was a clear winner or a clear loser when it came to taking peripheral biopsies. So that was the general way we thought about it. It took a little bit of time to come up with a clear description of the strategies, because over time the needle was argued that it really was standard, but really that wasn't the case in all centers, and that some people still just did biopsies and washings, or biopsies and brushings, and not all the different tools. And so we decided to break down, for the purposes of analysis, a limited biopsy strategy, wash-brush biopsy, and compare it to an extended range of biopsies, which included needles and all the other tools that I just spoke about. And then try to figure out if there's a difference in yield between the different groups, and not only differences in yield, but then look at the safety of these things. So one of the concerns that people have about taking fewer biopsies is, or more biopsies, I should say, is if, you know, is there some risk of using the needle of these other biopsies? Is there increased risk of pneumothorax or bleeding or other sorts of stuff? And then, you know, ideas about cost and that sort of stuff. We also looked at the use of rows. Again, if you have on-site cytopathology, is it impacted by biopsy choice? And so we tried to look at all those things and understand if there is a standard in the world of people who do these sorts of things.
Great. Now, maybe you could comment on the use of the needle, because we've been increasingly aware that a lot of these nodules are actually outside the airway, and obviously a brush or a forceps would not get to that unless the needle had gone through initially. So maybe comment on that. And then also, there's no mention of cryobiopsy, which may have predated or come after your study. Maybe comment on those two points.
Sure. So the first point about the needle was a great one. And interestingly enough, I saw data going back to the 60s and 70s showing the needle's value. And in fact, every time I give a lecture about these sorts of things, I put up the Suboy classification that clearly shows from pathologic data that nodules don't always exist happily at the end of airways. And so we did know about the bronchus sign, and we did know about other features. And so the idea that a needle could breach bronchial walls and reach through distances always just seemed to make sense. And so, you know, it always struck me as odd that we didn't have good needles for the periphery, but more importantly, that we didn't use them even when we had them. So that was sort of an interesting comment about this. Clearly, people were very comfortable with forcep biopsies, but in my experience, it's the forcep biopsies. And that was also borne out in some of the acquired data unrelated to the NAV study, that the forcep biopsies of the lung is where most of our complications come from, bleeding and pneumothorax, importantly. So it always struck me as odd that the needle was not considered a favorite tool of folks, and there was considered to be risky. But in reality, it probably was one of the safer instruments we used, and it just, for some reason, was underused. And so it was just an odd thing. So that's the view of the needle. And of course, needle technologies have changed over time to make it possible to get into the deep lung, and so there's different brands we could talk about in regard to that. Now, this paper and this concept to Navigate was done prior to the widespread availability to do cryobiopsies, and I'm aware of the Oberg paper and some others showing increased yield in terms of getting larger chunks of tissue, even with lesions adjacent to the airway. So that, you know, that's a very interesting and new addition to the armamentarium of biopsy choices, and I'm aware of some other studies that are future state that will hopefully answer some more questions about the overall utility, not just in cancer, but in other diseases as well.
Great. So let's jump into your key findings. What did you find using a restrictive versus extensive approach, and what do you think that means?
Well, the first thing we learned is that there really is no standard. You know, Dr. Mehta, my mentor, gives me a lot of trouble about talking about cryobiopsy and realizing there's guidelines written about cryobiopsy, but there's really no guidelines around taking a forceps biopsy. And so it's interesting that when we looked at the data, there was not only a clear strategy, centers using the same techniques over and over again, but they never used them in the same order, and not everybody used all the same tools. And in fact, in this particular study, a third of all the patients who had the limited biopsy strategy all came from one center. So it was really interesting just to know that there's so much wide variation, even within centers where people did different biopsy types at the time. And you know, we sort of analyzed that to figure out all sorts of really interesting insights, like The extensive strategy was more commonly used in smaller nodules, which was odd. And the extensive biopsy types had slightly lower complications, but not statistically significant. So we just learned a lot about the variation in the practice as the first thing. The second thing we learned is that when we looked at individual biopsy types, even within the extensive and limited, there was no statistical difference in the overall outcome. But really what was interesting is that no instrument significantly outperformed another one, and no individual instrument achieved all of the yield. So the way the study was conducted was that we looked at all patients who had a cancer diagnosis, and then when we looked at each individual biopsy type, not one of them reached 100%. So among patients with known cancers, the needle and the forceps, you know, both reached around 87% yield, but when you put them together, they still only reached about 90-something percent yield. And so it always took more instruments or multiple instruments to really get the most out of the yield. So that was a very interesting way of looking at it as the primary sort of idea there. The second part we learned, which was really interesting, is that when you take very limited biopsies or extensive biopsies, there did not appear to be any increased risk. So that was a big deal. Again, worrying about using all these other tools contributing to risk did not result in increasing pneumothorax or increase in bleed. So the idea that taking more biopsies only increases risk was not the case in this study. So it was very reassuring for that from that standpoint.
Maybe you could comment on the variation in the biopsy workflow. Why do you think that happened? It seems as though we as clinicians each have our own unique way of doing it. And the fact that we're each doing it differently means that maybe it's because every lung nodule is different, the approach is different, it's physician preference. What did you attribute that to?
It's interesting. My view on this has changed over time. It used to be that when we first started doing electromagnetic navigation, I thought that the best instrument to use first was the instrument that was less likely to cause catheter deflection. So, you know, with the older instrumentation, it being a passive catheter, I used to prefer to use the brush first because it was really passive and it would pass through the airway, and I could, you know, take long swaths of brush passes, take large pieces of, you know, scrapings over a large area without dislodging the catheter. And I used to use that first. But over time, I realized that the specimens became quite bloody when they did that. So I would switch over to using needles. But I found that the needles, unless I had a small, short needle, something like the SuperTrax or later on the ArcPoint, that dislodged the catheter quite a bit if it was long. But in the short version, I actually got a really good tissue and it didn't bleed very much. So that was a nice thing. And I usually saved the forceps for last because, again, the forceps, depending on which one you used again, would cause a lot of flexion. And then if you look at even stiffer instruments like the triple needle brush, which I describe as a zone biopsy, is like 10 to 15 millimeters long, and that really would deflect the catheter. So you can clearly imagine that if you were worried about catheter deflection in any given case, you may have chosen to use a different strategy for a specific lesion. Although sometimes I just think that people just do what they're used to and don't think about it so much. So it was really impossible to tell from the data to know what people were thinking, except to say that, you know, clearly people chose different pathways and not only within centers made different choices. But there were some centers actually that did the same thing over and over again. You know, they just always took four or five different types of biopsy types. So really it told me that some people were very thoughtful about it and had some theories about why they did it a certain way. I certainly was in that camp. Then I saw other people that just had a strategy and they employed it. So it sort of tells me that there really isn't a lot of data, or at least there wasn't at the time, and maybe there continues not to be significant data that tells people exactly what instrument to use when or how many to use, and more importantly, how many times to take a biopsy. So it really is an open book.
And your study found that an extensive biopsy strategy improved results, but as you said, no specific tool was superior to another. This is in contrast with the Oberg paper, which you referenced, where they found that cryobiopsy diagnosed cancer exclusively in 18% of cases. What are your thoughts on cryobiopsy, and are you using it? Have you found any benefit? Some have said that it's beneficial because you can target eccentric lesions, which is difficult with a needle or forceps.
Yeah, so, we haven't done it yet. We have done cryobiopsies in the past with regard to interstitial lung disease, and we were one of the centers that published that we found a whole lot of complications without a whole lot of benefit to it. So, you know, we're sort of a little bit of an outlier in the scheme of things, and that was based on our experience. Cryobiopsy now with the 1.1 millimeter probe is very interesting to us. We have not started doing that as a practice just yet. We're thinking about it with regard to a clinical trial that's coming up, sponsored out of Hopkins, and we're hoping to join that study. So we're looking to do it in a prospective, you know, IRB sort of way to really understand this. Again, we haven't done it in our clinical practices, but it certainly is of significant interest to us. And we'll certainly see how it plays out. The Oberg paper was great because it did show in a large number of cases, I think it was 18% or something, where there's an increase in the yield just on that instrument alone, and that's unique. In our paper, we just showed that, you know, the needles and forceps reached about 87%, and when you put them together, it did increase it to like 92%, but, you know, often other instruments were helpful. I don't know that the Oberg paper was large enough to look at all the different possible perturbations that could be used there, but in and of itself, an increase in yield just with that one instrument is certainly a very valuable added benefit to what we can do if it continues to prove to be valuable in safety and in large numbers.
And then maybe you could comment on the delivery system. So obviously there's the tool, the needle, the brush, the forceps, the cryobiopsy probe, but then also, as I think you've referenced already, the delivery system, what type of catheter it is. In this paper, you'll use the SuperD Dimension platform with electromagnetic navigation. What has been your experience since? Are you using robotic technologies? Have you found any difference subsequent to this with the use of different tools?
It's hard to know right now. We have the unusual benefit of having, you know, both the Monarch robot and the Ion robot. We used it with and without CIOS spin. We have the Body Vision system, and we've certainly still used the Super Dimension, or in this case, the Illumisight system. So, you know, every different machine has its pluses and minuses, but at the end of the day, they're catheters, you know, from a biopsy standpoint. And so I don't really have a great sense that that there's so much difference in how the tools are deployed, except that the robotic technology is an active system, as opposed to some of the catheter-based systems where you do have to pay attention a little bit more to deflection. I'd say that there still is deflection that does occur in the robotic systems as well, but they seem to have abilities to manage that. But there's still you know, issues around getting tools into the lung, and different, you know, biopsy types continue to be challenged. Now, of course, we're seeing problems with supply chain. You know, there's certain biopsy tools we can't get and needles we can't get. So it's really been an interesting time to understand not only how these things work technically, but, you know, really how they work in actual practice.
Great. And then maybe you could comment on your ROSE strategy, because as we've learned going forward, it's very important to have communication with the pathologist. We shouldn't be expecting diagnostic versus diagnostic as the answer. We need to be probing them as to what they're seeing, what cells they're seeing, which site is best. Maybe you could comment on what ROSE strategy all employed, or people employed during the Navigate trial, and any suggestions to our audience on what you would recommend.
It's a great question, and, you know, it's really interesting. In this particular study, ROSE had some pretty cool insights. Number one is that, you know, 86%, I think, of the sites used ROSE. So that seemed like a pretty high number to me, and that's pretty cool from a, you know, what was the value of it for people, and people clearly see value in it. So that's number one. Number two, we've learned that not everybody does ROSE the same. You know, so ROSE is a cytopathologic evaluation for adequacy. Is sort of how it was originally described in some of these papers, was used as a diagnostic test. So it wasn't just mere adequacy, but also an attempt to give a diagnosis. Further, we learned that some centers don't use ROSE for specific biopsy types. For example, we don't use ROSE with forceps. You know, that's called a touch prep, and so my pathologists don't particularly like to use that. So we learned that there's some variation in there as well. We also learned that the ROSE diagnosis in these patients, when they were able to get a diagnosis, was consistent only 71% of the time. So on the day of the procedure, you can give someone a diagnosis 70% of the time, and you know, 30% of the time, you're not going to be able to give an answer that is consistent with the final diagnosis. So that was a very interesting thing. We looked at that in another one of our papers in the past, and I think we're at 75% here at Main Campus. And then interestingly, we learned in the study that if you had ROSE, you did slightly fewer biopsy types, but not, you know, a single one. And it turned out that, again, people did this quite differently. Some people would send out specimens and wait for a result, and then if they got a result, would stop. And in other centers, they would move on and continue to biopsy over and over again. And then only when pathology came on later on did they consider to reduce the number or stop the number of biopsies. So there was a difference in, you know, the number of biopsies. If you had rows, that people did fewer on average, but it didn't really ever drop down to one or two. So that was interesting. And the other thought we learned that was interesting is that most of the time when we got an answer early on, you can get it with the first instrument on rows, which was kind of an interesting finding. So lots of insights about rows in the study, and certainly rows has evolved significantly over time. We have evolved to use rows really more along the lines these days for directing specimen management after the biopsy. So if we get a diagnosis up front, or at least suspicion of, say, a non-small cell cancer, then we have a way of triaging the specimen to get more tissue that we might send on for next generation sequencing or molecular analysis that requires a formalin specimen. Or if something like non-small cell or other tumors or squames come up, then we would process the specimen slightly differently. So we use it as a tool to help us triage the specimen. And again, we could also use it to reduce the number of biopsies if we're getting adequate tissue. So rows is interesting, and it's evolved over time, and certainly it has its role, and we continue to use it with great favor with our team.
Great. And then maybe you could comment on, it seems as though the technology is advancing and being deployed and utilized by physicians and surgeons at a much greater pace than the literature or publications actually support it. There seems to be a dearth of really high quality studies to show that some of these technologies, the combination of technologies, the practices that we are doing. Are there any plans to actually address which system is better, which system actually achieves what it's supposed to, or are we just going to have to wait and see what happens eventually? What are your comments on that?
Wow, that's a great question, and it's really interesting. You know, I'm of the mind that these things happen and these explosions of technologies happen because clearly there's an unmet need. So the fact that people think that they can do better and have a pretty good sense of why they are limited in certain ways drives the idea that, these technologies are valuable, and that this is an unmet need and we can do better. And clearly, I think, the data would tell us that, bronchoscopic biopsies clearly are safer than or percutaneous biopsies. That seems to have shown over and over again. And the idea that we can combine staging and diagnosis in one procedure seems to carry weight. And there's lots of evidence evolving around cost effectiveness and that sort of stuff. So I think that clearly the explosion is related to the idea that there's an unmet need. Now, comparative studies are difficult. I have this idea or this word I use that describes the idea of technical evolution bias. And so by the time you can compare two technologies, they're already antiquated. So Siwei Lo, one of my colleagues who, when she was working at Vanderbilt, published a paper looking at the first generation of shape sensing robot compared to the Illumisite system with tomosynthesis and showed them to be relatively equivalent. But we've already moved on to shape sensing robot with external CIA spin, another technology. So, it's interesting to see that comparative studies are getting done in small ways, but they're hard to keep up with because the pace of technology is moving so rapidly. So I think it's valuable. I think it's useful in some circumstances for policy decisions or maybe making business decisions. But I think that the pace of technology is keeping up with the idea that we can achieve more and we can do more, and there's an unmet need.
And then how do we address this issue of there's some that have published meta-analyses looking at navigation platforms, and I've said, over the last 30 years, they've seen no meaningful difference. The diagnostic yield is still 70%, but that meta-analysis didn't include the more recent robotic technologies. And the papers that have reported on robotic technologies are reporting yields of 90%, 93%. Is this a question of publication bias? Some of the authors who performed the systematic review, citing no benefit, have raised concerns that maybe there are some really great clinicians or proceduralists who are getting outstanding results, but they also seen a separate group who are using this technology and are not getting the same diagnostic yields, but obviously incurring the expense. How do we address that issue?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. The point I was making before about evolution, technical evolution bias is true. I think that there are folks who are really getting good yield. And of course, there's a whole debate to be had about what yield is. The idea of yield has changed significantly over the years, going back to how I originally defined it back in the old days, which would really be considered a very liberal way of looking at yield with some of the first papers, versus sort of the acquire very strict definition of yield. And so looking at yield just in itself, just using that word, is a very different word depending on the study that you look at. So that's hard. Just the outcome itself is hard to measure. I also think that there was quite a bit of nihilism about what you biopsied 15 years ago in terms of how many different kinds of tools you would use or why you would even attempt such a biopsy in the periphery. I think that's changed a lot. I think that we are biopsying smaller lesions and attempting more biopsies than we ever would before that we would never have done in the past. And so there's all kinds of biases that go into this. It also points to the fact that what we originally start talking about, maybe it's not always the technology that increases your yield. Maybe it's a matter of how your specimens are managed or what biopsy types you do or your ventilation strategy or patient positioning. So many other things can factor into this that get attributed to the technology, which may have nothing to do with it. And we've seen this over and over again, the diagnostic drop. Every technology has a measure of success relative to, say, navigation success or imaging success, looking at things like the Precise One trial where they're showing tool-in lesion. And yet we still don't have the yield that equates to those things. Something has to be missing. So I think there's so many pieces to this. I think the literature is evolving in a way that we can learn a lot about why these drop-offs happen, and we have to approach them all differently. And then I'm hoping that the papers get written in a way that we can start to pick out where the challenges may be. If you look at some of these papers, they talk about yield, but they don't necessarily talk about exactly what the biopsy strategy was or how the specimens were processed. So many different things go into this, and I think it's a great time to be in the field to have an opportunity to learn more.
It's definitely an exciting time, and we're at the cutting edge of revolutionizing lung cancer treatment and care. Maybe you could comment on the limitations of your study. There are no perfect studies, and this was a retrospective post-hoc analysis. Maybe comment for our audience what you want them to be aware of so that when they go forward, they can address any limitations that you note.
Yeah, so as good as this study was in terms of learning things about what we did learn, it's got tremendous amounts of problems. And the biggest problem is we don't really have a comparator group. This was just those that were diagnosed. So it doesn't tell us anything about those that were not diagnosed. So if you were to say that in this particular study in the Navigate trial, I think yields around 60 to 70 something percent. And that tells you that 30 to 40% of the patients didn't have an answer and what strategies were different in the negative group versus the positive group. So big limitation there. It also tells us that it's hard to make comparisons if one center works very differently than another center. So in this paper, one center was attributed to 34% of all of the limited diagnostic groups. And so it's really hard to get into the details of small things when one center may have significantly contributed to one group versus another. And the fact that, we didn't get into the detail of number of passes per biopsy. So that's a significant limitation in terms of not knowing exactly, maybe four passes was better than three or two or one, or how many transbronchial biopsies contributed to the yield. So a lot of things that we could have learned differently. The fact that the Navigate investigators did not or didn't even try to standardize biopsy types is interesting because that tells us that we didn't really know what to do, so I think it was valuable. Comparator groups being missing, of course, I said that in the beginning. All these things can lead to the idea that post-hoc analysis is only as good as the volume of observations and what the possible comparators are. So significant limitations for sure. It does tell me, though, at the end of the day, that more biopsy tools is better than any one. And that's, I think, been proven over and over again. And in this case, I think the most thing I would learn that, two to three different kinds of biopsies is the best way to get the highest possible yield.
And then maybe you could comment on the use of radial EBUS, whether it was used routinely in the study. And then also, it appears that in the restricted group, the average lesion size was 17 millimeters, and then in the extensive group, the average lesion size is 25 millimeters, which is a significant difference. It's a lot more difficult to go for smaller lesions than larger ones. How would that have affected your analysis?
Yeah, on the EVA side, I don't know the answer to that, quite honestly. I don't remember us paying much attention to it. I think by the time this paper was written, EBUS was pretty ubiquitous. I don't remember that anybody was doing these without EBUS, but it's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. With regard to lesion sizes and instrument choice is interesting, and we did mention that briefly. The idea of using a limited biopsy strategy in small lesions may be attributed to the idea that smaller lesions increase risk. I don't know that that's true, but that certainly is one hypothesis, and that larger lesions you feel much better about taking lots of biopsies for. So I don't know, but that was at least one hypothesis proposed by the authors.
And then what does the study mean? So going forward, after completing the paper, what take-home message do you want our audience to be aware of? How does this study impact clinical care and practice?
So I think for me, it really comes down to the idea that it validates the concept that more biopsy types and more biopsies is better. So despite whatever technology you use to get to a lesion, if you don't take lots of different kinds of biopsies and you're not mindful about obtaining specimens in different ways, you're just not going to get the full benefit of the technology's worth. So for me, that's really the end of the, you know, the beginning and end of this, is to show that, yes, in fact, more biopsies is better. The second part that I think is important to remember is that more biopsies doesn't mean increased risk. And so if you're sort of worried about adding a needle or a forceps or one of these other biopsies, it really did not show out in large data to have a major impact on the overall risk of the procedure itself. Those are probably other unrelated things.
And then, Tom, you've taken some time to prepare for this podcast. Is anything that we have not covered that you want our audience to be aware of or to be mindful of that you think would really impact them?
Probably not much, really. You know, at the end of the day, I usually preach the value of, you know, not necessarily being so wrapped up in the high-end technology. It's very, very valuable. But don't forget the basics. You know, we didn't touch on the fact that, you know, there's data out there that says that just aspirating a catheter has been shown to be better than a forceps biopsy, at least in two different papers. So, you know, at the end of the day, getting your specimens and getting your tissue and, you know, reminding ourselves that these questions have been on the table since the 60s, and these technical challenges have been known for 50 years, and we're still sort of working on them, is sort of an interesting view into the world. And although there's been an explosion of technologies to help get us those places, and I think that's incredibly valuable, the lessons of the past and the things that we've learned over the last 50 years continue to be relevant, and they continue to be insightful. And I continue to learn so much more about the nuances of these procedures. And so I hope other people share my enthusiasm for thinking about these things differently.
Oh, definitely. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure interviewing you. For our audience, we discussed the paper entitled The Impact of Biopsy Tool Choice and Rapid On-Site Evaluation on Diagnostic Accuracy for Malignant Lesions in the Prospective Multicenter Navigate Study. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure indeed. Thank you so much.
A big thank you to Dr. Gilday, and a big thank you to all of you for listening to This Is The Way podcast. I'm Dominic Pepper for the Society of Advanced Bronchoscopy.